You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello, there we go. You are listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM. I'm your host, Amy, and the show today is brought to you from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. And I'd like to pay my respects to any First Nations people listening today. We're going to be talking today with a really interesting crew. Their names are Ashton and Sam. Ashton and Sam, hello, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Yeah.
Lovely, thank you.
Better move your mic there a bit closer there, Ashton. You guys are from this this group called Urban Gorillas. So that's right, folks. We're talking about killing lawns today. Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is simply, if you haven't heard it before, Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence is a show about how we can sort of tackle our urban environments like the cities and suburbs and sort of challenge the way that they've been built a bit. You know, our cities and suburbs were designed on a model of capitalism and growth and colonialism, all those isms that we tend to not like here at 3CR. And they're not very good for the ecology and the environment. That's the Kill Your Lawn thing. But the Kill Your Lawn movement is very individualistic. It sort of targets on your own backyard. And unfortunately, as good as that is for your local ecology, it's not very good at challenging systems. So that's why I like to have groups like these folks who sort of go a bit beyond that sort of individualistic approach. And then Kicking Your Fence is about how we all live in little boxes. We live in little boxes, we go to work in little boxes, and we're very alienated from one another. You might have a household of other people, and you're alienated by technology and social media within the household. So Kicking Fences is about how we can build communities and maybe go as far as to redesign our suburbs and knock down some fences and learn how to share and care for this planet. Let's talk to Urban Gorillas about killing lawns today. So whoever would like to start, Ashton or Sam, who are Urban Gorillas? And who are you two as well? Actually, let's start with who are you two. Sam, who are you?
My name is Sam Russell. I'm the founder and president of Urban Gorillas. So I work in ecological restoration. For those who don't really know, it's basically, you know, the kind of just killing weeds and protecting natives. Yeah. A basic summary. We'll get into that a bit more later.
Yeah.
I don't really know deep down.
That's
like,
all good.
What do you want to know?
No, that's good. We know your background and who you are. And, Ashton, who are you?
I'm Ashton. I am on the executive team of Urban Gorillas.
Yeah.
I study environmental science. I've been with Urban Gorillas for about 2 years, 2.5 years?
Yep.
And I study environmental science in my final year, at RMIT. And I do a lot of other volunteering with volunteer nurseries and friends groups of the environment. I've been involved with quite a few, and I've had to cut back now that I'm really focusing on some groups that I think are really worth my time, like the Urban Gorillas.
Oh, that's so cool. So you both have these sort of backgrounds and personal interests in this sort of thing. So next question, who are Urban Gorillas?
Cool. Yeah, so I can definitely talk to that. So Urban Gorillas is a group of environmentalists that want to restore indigenous biodiversity to urban landscapes.
Mm.
We do this by connecting friends of groups, institutions like universities and TAFEs, the general community as well. And we're trying to bridge the gap between all these sort of separate community groups and bring them together. So we work in the sort of the in-between dots, so like in that sort of intermediate zone where we're trying to bridge people together to build that sense of community, but in the meantime also restore indigenous biodiversity back to urban landscapes because it's much needed. And we do that by planting indigenous plants, but also we educate as well. So we do educational workshops. So we do like plants, fungi, bird watching. Ooh. Just trying to do variety of things.
So tell me a little bit more about these education workshops. Sounds like it's very holistic, which is, we'll talk about later, it's not something that happens in the industries where you get paid to do stuff. So tell me a little bit about the education that you do. I think some people will be very interested to maybe even attend some of that.
Yeah. So Ashton, they ran a workshop earlier this year. So it's...
plant propagation workshop, native germination workshop. I don't think we really got the name down pat perfectly, but, you know, it was all about growing native plants, and by native, emphasizing indigenous plants over native plants, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just a great opportunity to share that knowledge without people having to go get a degree or anything, or without having to, you know, pay exorbitant amounts for knowledge, which really should be commonplace, which really should be part of our culture. Like, there's such an underappreciation of XYZ in our environment, mostly because we come from a colonial culture, which obviously hasn't had much of this environment built into it structurally.
And, you know, gardening in general, like plants, these are skills that anyone can learn. And traditionally, people did learn these skills without degrees. So it was passing down knowledge, and so... tell me a little bit about, like, the ethos of your education, like, the philosophy, like, how you approach it. It sounded kind of quite, like, all-encompassing, like, you do a lot of different things.
I think the strength that I bring to UG is finding people who have knowledge and then bringing them to the community that otherwise wouldn't have regular access to that knowledge. It's the sort of dismantling that hierarchy of, you know, education equals you have money, which isn't the case. You know, it's definitely challenging that idea, and we do try and make our workshops as accessible to all as possible. So our workshop with Ashton, we limited it to like $15 a ticket. We do that as well to make sure that we actually secure tickets as well, and people actually rock up and enjoy the workshop. But that's kind of a band of, we don't go any higher than like $20.
Yeah, well, that's good. And so you've got a, I've noticed you've got like a project around Darabin Creek. Maybe you, is that, you
Somewhat, we can expand on that one,
I just thought that might be a good example to explain how you do the planting. Like, what, how does that work? It doesn't have to be Darabin, but it can be, how do you go about that? Because that's sort of interesting, because, you know, if I turn up to my local park, for example, that's a multi-purpose, multi-use space that's used for different parts of the community. So if I turn up and suddenly start ripping out plants, I'm probably going to get into trouble. But there are these other spaces that I notice urban gorillas tend to go to, which I really like, because I think there's a lot of neglected spaces out there.
Definitely.
So maybe you could tell me a little bit more how you go about this.
So we sort of scout areas that would be in that sort of liminal space between, you know, who really owns it, who sort of, it's sort of like an arbitrary zone where you've got councils who sort of aren't really too sure either. So, like, you know, you get municipalities like Melbourne Water and, and councils. And, you know, there's some sort of grey zones.
Or Vic Roads.
Definitely.
So, folks, what we're talking about is the sort of weird borders that exist in maintenance. And so, basically, you have your local council, but say you're going, why don't they do that bit over there? Well, that bit might belong to Melbourne Water, or that bit over there might belong to Vic Roads because it's close to the highway. And every time you complain to the council, they go, oh, okay, we'll pass it on to Vic Roads. So there's all this stuff going on. And then there's often these, as you said, liminal spaces where you've probably seen them, particularly in the outer areas of Melbourne or places like Geelong, where it's just endless sort of shabby lawn. And basically the cheapest thing for a council or any of these groups to manage it is just to have someone mow it once a month.
We end up trying to find and locate these areas, and if there is enough kind of community push to restore these areas, then, you know, things can be challenged, community can be engaged. But also, you know, if you are sort of to take it upon yourself, you kind of can do it. We'll touch on that.
I mean, so that's probably the thing I come across in my job is people who sort of go solo to try and do this stuff. And if you're one of those people out there, I really encourage you to actually try and talk to your neighbors and actually try and get a feel for what your community does and uses that space, because Basically, you may think this is rubbish, but you don't know who else is using that space and how it's being used and what the rest of the community thinks. And you've got to be community-minded and keep them in mind. Yes.
We had a lot of... So the areas that we mostly work is along Gardner's Creek Reserve, and that's the legitimate sort of area that we do work.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of interesting conversations with dog owners because it's an off-leash dog park.
Yeah.
And so we have to keep in mind about how they use the park, and because they also have an entitlement to the area. You know, it's not, there's not many spaces in NAM that actually, well, you know, because of urbanization, you know, those spaces are being pushed aside and all that. So yeah, open dialogue is really critical to make sure that everyone's sort of happy. You know, some arguments that they have is not just necessarily them, but some arguments that the general public have, I'm like, let's push for habitat and our nature, like natural,
I'm guessing areas. They often are concerned that you're going to somehow bring snakes into the dog park.
Yeah, petrified of snakes.
Which, funnily enough, folks, casuarinas or she-oaks, they're very, if you look up Google search, or sorry, search engine search, don't use Google, she-oaks, you'll come across them, and they make a great border plant if you do have snakes, because their pines irritate the snake scales, and First Nations people used to tell their children to stay close to the she-oaks because the snakes don't go over the pine needles. So
I recently learned that as well. That's really cool.
So we've talked a little bit about how and what you do. How do you get the plants? How do you do that? Do you work with like Vinc or places like that, or
so we apply for grants through our grants have been through Melbourne Water. We strongly work in collaboration with other groups. So again, it's about community and collaboration. And sometimes we don't necessarily buy the plants ourselves. We just come in and help actually plant them, which adds to the element of, you know, supporting the groups and all that. So Vinc, there's plenty of nurseries that we do.
Vinc is a co-op, Victorian Indigenous
Nursery
Cooperation. Cooperative. Yep.
I think so.
Yeah.
But there's tons of other Indigenous nurseries, particularly in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
Yep.
There's plenty. We've got a whole list of them, but I won't go through it all.
Yeah.
Which are really, really, really valuable. And you can source fairly different genetics from each one, because they often collect from the bushland, so you can ensure you get that nice ecological diversity in what you're planting as well.
How do you select plants?
It depends on the site.
Yeah.
There's a really good resource, Nature Kit, which is a government website. There's also The Flora of Melbourne, which is another really good Marilyn Bull. Shamelessly plug her book. She's amazing.
That book is the Bible of management and conservation. Yes.
100% in Melbourne, at least.
Probably needs a bit of an update on some of the language she uses, but yes.
Oh, yeah. So,
Some grasses.
But they're
still really valuable resources when it comes to working out what the original vegetation would have been in a site. So whenever we take a site, we look at the historical EVC, so the ecological vegetation class, what sort of vegetation community it would have been, and try and restore that habitat, the layers of habitat, so the understory, middle story, canopy, as best as we can, and really get as much, pack in as much diversity as possible. So we try not to do one species, like a lot of landscape outcomes are just a bunch of Lamandra or a bunch of poas and a bunch of tussock grasses, and they leave it at that, or maybe some goodenias or some kangaroo grass, and that's it. But we really try and get as much diversity, as much value as you can into that site.
So one of the magical things about doing any kind of work like this is you spend time in a site and you learn by observing and doing. Could you both share something that you've learned and seen? Like maybe it's seeing the birds come, seeing something special. Could you maybe share some cases of that, maybe one or two from both of you?
There's nothing better than going out doing weeding and having the kookaburras and the butcher birds sit on the trees above you waiting for you to pull out a juicy snail hiding amongst, and these snails, most of the garden snails you see, those brown common ones, they're an introduced species, particularly bad for orchids and other lilies, because you know they with their introduction, they devour them. They're delicious.
And if you're feeling brave, you can turn them into escargot. They are the snails they use for escargot.
Oh, they're really? Try that.
Yeah. I'm always a bit worried that they're going to be full of lead or something, but yes.
A little bit of asking. It's all good.
As long as they're in a nice, healthy garden.
Yeah.
But that's one of the best nature interactions you can have, is pulling out the weeds and then throwing an invasive species to these kookaburras and butcher birds whenever you get the chance.
Magpies really too, good. As well, I've noticed do that, yeah.
Yeah.
And how about you?
I definitely agree with Ashton. Like, you know, it's the nature that sort of comes back and flocks around. Like, the birds are a really special moment when you're actually in that space. But I think as well, like, as you do ecological restoration, and it's less of an immediate gratifying result, and it's rather just like the slow burn, so you can see what your efforts are proceeding to. So with your hand weeding, you can actually, if you give space the grasses to actually spread out and grow, you can actually revisit, and you can see it in real time, you know, or over time, you know, actually like taking over and, you know, doing or winning the fight against invasive plants. And it's really rewarding.
Before and after photos. Yes. Very important.
The pain of my existence.
Because we get to take it before and then after, it's too late. But you get those in, it feels amazing.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go to a break and then we'll keep chatting. After this, you're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM or on the Community Radio Plus app or on 3cr.org.au/streaming. We will be back in just a moment.
Capitalism's inherent barbarism is on full display, from the genocide in Gaza and the rise of the far right, to growing militarism and the climate crisis.
We need to radically change the way society is organised.
Join us for the upcoming Eco-Socialism 2025 conference, Eco-Socialism, Not Barbarism, held on September 5th to the 7th at the Balam Balam Place in Brunswick.
We will be bringing together activists from across the Indo-Pacific, sharing experiences to resist capitalism's drive to barbarism and build the mass movements that we need.
Anyone who wants to be part of the discussion on how we can build a left-wing alternative is welcome to attend.
Featuring international guests from the United States, Pakistan, India, Malaysia, and Brazil, along with local campaigners.
Organised by Green Left and Socialist Alliance. Find out more by going to ecosocialism.org.au.
Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yorta Yorta, Jajarong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
That's right. Free Palestine. And welcome back to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. We're here today with Ashton and Sam from Urban Gorillas, talking all things urban gorilla and planting indigenous plants. you both have not only this project is an interest in this stuff, but also you're studying at Ashton, and you actually come from the industry, Sam.
Yeah.
And one of the things about this show is, so this show is, I guess, a bit of a counterculture, and we're countering how we live and how we sort of live in the cities and suburbs and how we think of nature. Because when you think about, when you talk to like most people, they have, this is how the world works. This is how things are done. But human history is incredibly diverse in terms of how things are done and appreciated. So we're sort of trying to challenge the how. So let's talk a little bit about that. And let's maybe start with industry. if you currently are working for someone, Sam, best not to actually mention anything specific about it, but in general terms. that's something I do. So generally, broadly speaking, folks out there, where it's gardening and landscaping, conservation, land management, it's all about, it's a maintenance model of managing budgets and money. So if you're very upset about how they always do lawns and mow them, or how they spray glyphosate, or they do lots of chemicals, I'm sorry to tell you, but that's what the client wants, because the client does not want to pay very much money, and those are the quickest ways to manage these things. When we study, we learn different controls. We learn mechanical controls, chemical controls, biological controls, and cultural controls. But we don't really use anything but chemical and a bit of manual and mechanical.
Yeah.
Cultural control might be burning, but as you've probably been following from some of our environmental justice shows, there's a big problem of people doing too hot burns and not the First Nations way of cool burns. So there's a lot of problems out there in the industry. It doesn't get talked about enough. So maybe we'll start with Sam. In general, I imagine you do a lot of spraying.
Oh, yeah. 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 I do a lot of, a lot of chemical use.
And with the time you have, I imagine that you couldn't do what you do without it.
No.
Exactly, right? So this is the thing, folks. If you want, under the system, the way that we manage things, we don't do stewardship. It's maintenance. It's capitalism. It's all paid. It's dime. Our jobs aren't considered to be contributing towards GDP or productivity. So we're really up against it when it comes to actually trying to do things in a more ecologically friendly way.
Yeah. It's sort of... You're very hamstrung by the tools that we actually are given.
Yeah.
You know, it's a race to the bottom when we apply for tenures.
Yeah.
So it's basically all the bush crews sort of like, you know, the municipalities, they bring out large tenures and they go, okay, who wants it? Who can prove that they can do it for the lowest price? And it's always a race to the bottom, which it also limits the actual industry as well the wages within.
Yeah.
And it's not a very high paying industry.
No. Nope.
It's actually one of the, like, I don't know if it's one of the lowest, but it is pretty darn low.
Yeah. Particularly when we're actually very skilled, knowledgeable workers.
Oh yeah.
And we never seem to be using those skills or knowledge.
No, it should, in my opinion, it should be definitely considered a trade.
Yeah.
You should be able to do an apprenticeship to actually achieve what we do.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have a lot of wits about you in weather conditions. You have to have plant knowledge, chemical knowledge.
Yeah. And folks, try identifying which grass is native and indigenous. Beyond kangaroo grass, good luck.
Yeah. grasses are notoriously hard.
Yeah.
And yeah, you really do need to like study and be trained to actually achieve what we do, which I think goes unnoticed by a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, oh, you're spraying weeds. But I challenge you to actually identify any of the plants that we identify. Very difficult.
My native grass knowledge is pretty poor just because I'm gardening and landscaping. And I was once for a council doing a little patch of native grasses and I had to hound them for their plant list because they don't give you that, by the way. There's a lot to talk about. But because there are like species of plants, well, technically genuses. Not enough time to explain that. But basically, you know, you have... a good example would be
acacia.
I'll go with cherries and plums.
Okay,
so they're in this genus called Prunus. And the differences between them might be, they might be the same species but a different cultivar or a subspecies, or they might be the same genus. So actually, eucalyptus is a genus. That's a better example. All the eucalyptuses that you know of that are eucalyptuses, some actually aren't eucalyptuses, anyway, are a genus. And then you have eucalyptus, camelodendrons, that's the red gum.
Camelodendrons, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
or cedroxylon, which is the iron bark.
Yeah.
So those are species. So it's just like these different levels of relation. So when it comes to grasses, there are some grasses that have that sort of genus, like eucalyptus, that are invasive and some that belong here. So good luck trying to identify the differences. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it also goes into like, is it from this specific region of Melbourne or is it over in that specific area?
Yeah.
So like the basalt plains or like the foothills of, you know, eastern Melbourne.
Yeah. So I imagine you, so you've seen that, how that works. So why did, Ashton, what you've been studying this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's funny you mentioned grasses. That's definitely my key area.
Yeah,
botany and grasses, identifying them.
Why are they important?
Why are they important? Oh, God. They're the baseline of our ecosystems, like key succession plant. They form pretty much the structure of the understory. I mean, if you talk about grasslands, it's the keystone plant, something like Demeter.
Yeah.
The kangaroo grass is the plant which makes up the ecosystem.
Yep.
And in the east, it's usually the last remnant you have in a lot of people's lawns. There is Microlina, there is Retidosperma. Yep. Almost dominant sometimes.
Yeah. And it's incredibly important for insects.
Yes. And butterflies as well, in particular, host plants.
And this is the thing that worries me. So I saw that Mary Beck was doing something really interesting, which was they were just letting some of their lawns go deliberately to see what had happened with, like, ecology and biodiversity. And that's the thing. If you notice a long lawn, there's little bugs and everything in it. It might not be perfectly indigenous and stuff, but there's life there.
Yeah.
So I worry about what us on the mowers regularly over these vast areas are contributing, and I don't know if there's research out there of what the horticulture industry is actually doing to insect populations.
Yeah, there's definitely research about like leaving your lawn to grow a little bit that improves invertebrate life.
Yeah.
And then if you go even further and you've got the flowering plants, like all the little daisies and stuff, you know, that increases exponentially.
And the reason I focus outside of people's individual gardens, please change your garden. If you're not a renter, I mean, renters, you're basically screwed. there are hectares and hectares and hectares out there in Victoria that are just getting mowed regularly because that's the cheapest option.
And there's ways around it. I will plug sort of the gorilla aspects a little bit.
Yeah.
If you are to do it, because it's obviously in the name and we have done it before, I won't say where, but if you are to do it, make sure you just do the research about what you're actually trying to achieve. And if you are to do it, you know, if you do think it's going to be better at consulting your neighbors and community, please do so. But also, if you are to do it, do the research, look at the resources that we can actually plug later on. So like Vic Flora, Flora of Melbourne, any indigenous nursery will be able to help you as well figure out what plants you need to plant.
I will also add your local registered Aboriginal party. So the local registered Aboriginal parties are corporations of, they're sort of like the official local body. And while sometimes they're not the best at agitating change because of how those corporate systems work, they do have an immense amount of knowledge and they are often very involved in local bushwork and ecology, and they actually do very well, do have a very good knowledge about what the local issues are and just in general law, as in L-O-R-E law and things like that. So they're also worth contacting. We're about to run out of time. So Ashton, I know. Ashton, would you like to tell me a little bit about how we can learn more about Urban Gorillas and where we can follow you?
Yeah, so we post quite frequently on Instagram at Urban Gorillas. That's G-U-E. I-double-L-A-S. I get it wrong sometimes.
Yeah, the Che Guevara's of horticulture.
Not official.
We've got another planting event coming up in September.
On the 7th.
The 7th.
Yeah.
That's our last one for the year, I believe.
Yeah, and we're also helping out the Riverfest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Riverkeeper's doing a big Riverfest this September. Mm-hmm. There's like 20 events and we're helping with a couple of them.
Yeah.
We've got an orchid workshop. We've got some other interesting ones like woodworking as well, but it's kind of like more like fiddle stuff. Yeah. It's sort of it's still community based.
Yeah.
A little bit of environment. It's wood.
Yeah.
That's a plant. That's nature. Yeah.
Nice.
It's something every weekend, I think, in September.
Yeah. We're busy in September. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to have you on again and talk more stuff, and maybe even if you have an event coming up that you want to spruik, you're always welcome to come on and chat about it and promote it. Yeah, it's been lovely having you.
Thank you
for listening to this segment. Stay tuned though, because we're going to talk about a mine in the fingerboards right after this message.
Have you heard about the news that's come out of the NT?
What news? Fires, floods, chicken flu, what?
No, the payouts.
Payouts?
Compensation for what you went through.
No.
Well, I reckon you should go for it. You deserve every cent and more. I'll back you. You know it.
Oh, sis, you're the best.
Yes, I am.
If you are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander and were removed from family or community in the Northern Territory before 1 July 1978 or in the ACT or Jervis Bay before 11th of May 1989, you may be eligible for the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme. If you know of a family member who was removed but passed away after the scheme was announced on the 5th of August 2001, you may be eligible to apply for redress for them. Call LinkUp Victoria, VACA, on 037 002 3700 and leave a message for a callback or contact the Territory Stolen Generations Redress Scheme on 1800 566 111.
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
You're listening to 3CR's Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, and I'm bringing you today a special story on an important issue happening on Kanai Kurnai country in Gippsland along the Mitchell River. This is a story about a community that has been fighting a mining company for about 11 years now along the Mitchell River in a place called the Fingerboards.
It's a massive danger, like when they start digging in 30, 40, 50 metres deep into the hills that supply the river, part of the catchment of the Mitchell River. If they dive through these gravel seams and water aquifers in that area, it runs straight in the river. You're looking at under 2K from the river, Mitchell River. And if that gets contaminated, and it will, the whole system will go down there. Irrigation water, drinking water, tourism water, Ramsar wetland, the whole package will be under threat.
A company called Gippsland Critical Minerals, formerly known as Calva Operations, is at it again, trying to build is known as an open-cut silica mine. This mine, the Fingerboards Mine, is of great concern to the local residents, farmers, and the Kanai Kurnai community. It has been staunchly rejected by the local community, Kanai Kurnai people, including the local registered Aboriginal party, the Kanai Kurnai's Land and Waters Aboriginal Corporation. This is a mine that not only threatens delicate and rare ecology, but also one of Victoria's biggest food bowls with some of Australia's biggest food growers.
So the Lindeno Valley for the last umpteen years has been producing around 500 tonnes of veggies a day. Most of that goes to wholesalers, direct to wholesalers, and then straight into Coles, Woolies, Aldi, etc. The remainder that doesn't go to the wholesalers makes up about a third of the Victorian fruit and veg market. And then there's truckloads and truckloads that also go up to the Brisbane markets, the Sydney markets, and the Adelaide markets. A small proportion of high-value product also gets exported. So it's huge.
And you're saying 500 tonnes?
500 tonnes.
Yeah, and that's growing.
Per day.
There are several concerns raised about the mine and how it can damage the local area. Firstly, are the contaminants within the mine.
The ore that they're looking for contains monazite. Monazite contains both thorium and uranium, both of which are radioactive.
If the winds from this open-cut mine pick up silica dust and the radioactive materials, this could cover the many crops that the farmers depend on. This would not only ruin local agricultural businesses, but it would also have a negative knock-on effect to the cost of living crisis. Not only does this affect 1,500 people with jobs invested in this business and the local residents, but it also affects nearby towns, including the towns of Bairnsdale, as this dust can potentially settle and contaminate in local town water supplies. Furthermore, this land is on dispersive soils with a very high water table, which can lead to more contamination and significant damage to the ecosystems and farmlands. And speaking of ecosystems, there is a magical and abundant diversity that I got to see firsthand touring the area with the local residents. We saw endangered species of plants and animals. We saw an incredible abundance of plants and animals. The proposed site is happening on a very significant amount of culturally sensitive areas to the Gunai Kurnai people. So to sum up, there is significant cultural damage, ecological damage, damage to local economies and businesses, damage to the local people's mental health over the course of this struggle, and a knock-on effect to the rest of our food systems and economy. But fortunately, the Mindfree Glen Allerdale crew, along with the Gunai Kurnai Land and Waters Aboriginal Corporation and the Thorpe family, are standing strong to take on this issue. So today, and over a series of episodes, you are going to hear how this issue affects them and their community.
Suddenly, rare earths aren't the be-all and end-all.
Yeah.
They can walk away. They don't have to fill up the holes. They don't have to do anything. They can put it in caretaker mode and leave it sitting there forever.
Yeah.
So it will never be rehabilitated.
Yeah. The strain the community's had to put up with over the last 11 years of just not knowing what's going on has been extraordinary. We've already had one attempt at suicide. And we had one young bloke who had a nervous breakdown.
We began my tour with a couple members from the Mindfree Glen Allerdale crew. They were driving me around and pointing out the various complications of water and the dispersive soils.
Yeah, because water is the major resource in the area.
Yeah.
Whether it's for, no matter what it's used for, it's the limiting resource. So yep. At the moment, it's limiting food production.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And there's a lot of talk about cost of living.
Yeah.
And the cost of fresh fruit and veg.
Yeah.
So anything that risks the viability of those fresh fruit and veg operations is directly impacting everyone's bottom line with their hip pockets. So the first take of tranche of the mine, they said they needed 3 gigalitres of water. Now that's 3,000 megalitres.
Right.
And a megalitre is 1 million litres.
Right.
So 3,000 million litres of water.
Yep.
Was what their experts said. When the community looked at their final proposal, when they finally released it in the EES, one of the community members said, you've got your maths wrong. You actually need 6,000 million litres, twice as much as they'd estimated.
Right.
And that caused a great deal of kerfuffle.
Hmm.
At the time, there was what they called winter fill available from the river.
Yeah.
And the company was proposing to use that winter fill. In the meantime, that winter fill's been fully allocated either to the veggie growers or to the Gunai Kurnai people, the First Nations people locally. So there is no water actually available for the mine at this stage.
Right.
They're under their new proposal, which is basically the same mine, they're again saying they need 3,000 million litres of water.
Right.
But they're not basing that on anything. It's just wave a finger in the air, oh yeah, 3 gigalitres sounds like a good number.
Yeah.
But whether it's 3 gigalitres or 6 gigalitres, it's just not there. If it was there, it would be way better used for food production, long-term sustainable. People have been growing veggies on these flats forever and will keep growing them forever, rather than a mine with a lifespan of who knows. If you look across the valley, you can see there's a flat-topped bank about halfway up the side of the valley.
Yeah.
That's actually the water storage for all the towns east of here.
Oh, okay, yep.
So
there's no cover on it.
It's enormous, yeah. Big open dams.
Yeah.
And so that supplies Lindenau, Bairnsdale, Painsville, Lakes Entrance, Bruthen, right through to Nowanowa.
Yeah.
Every town.
Yeah.
It's directly downwind from the proposed mine site. All the locals rely on water catchment from their roofs for water.
Yeah.
And of course their roofs will get absolutely covered in dust.
Yeah.
And so all the locals' water supplies will get contaminated as well.
Yeah.
I mentioned the complexity of the landscape.
Yeah.
A lot of that's been governed by the fact that we have what they call dispersive soils.
Right.
So these are subsurface clays that dissolve in water.
Yeah.
So one of the consequences of that is that you can have a paddock that looks quite normal and happy and be driving across it, but underneath the ground are these big erosion tunnels.
Yeah.
It doesn't erode on the surface, it erodes underneath the surface.
Yeah.
So it makes it a really, really tricky environment to work in.
Mm.
Because as soon as you start disturbing those dispersive soils, they will erode. So there's a few consequences. One is that a lot of dams in the area fail.
Yeah.
Because the clay just leaches out of the walls.
Yeah.
And in fact, East Gippsland Water's big dams over there that are the water storage dams and yeah. were put to that they're multi-million dollar facilities. So they no money was skimped on their construction.
Yeah.
They're having troubles with the dams failing and water starting to leak out of them.
Mm.
And once you get water leaking through, it exacerbates and you get tunnels through and wall collapse, etc. This is a big, big issue because not only does it mean that dams fail, but any disturbance, such as mining, means that that'll erode. But it's also a safety issue for the guys operating within the mine, because if you get a wet environment, this clay turns to soup. Earthworkers call it spew.
Yeah.
Which is very romantic. On the property next to us, there was an instance in one of the wet years where a bulldozer got bogged up to its cabin at the top of a ridge, just because the ground had turned to soup underneath it. So you can actually see the erosion happening there.
Mm.
The lighter patches of grass are where there's actually exit points from the erosion, where the tunnel has come out, and it comes out like a water bubbler.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary to watch.
Yeah.
And if you look down the gully, you can just see how badly that soil erodes. It just dissolves.
It's pretty massive.
During my trip, I was treated to a wonderful lunch at a local community cricket hall with the rest of the Mindfree Glen Allerdale crew. It was here I saw several tables filled with maps, papers, and research that the Mindfree Glen Allerdale crew had meticulously gone over in their 11-year struggle against the proposed mine. Here I was shown a map of the water table created by government-funded agencies. The map showed that the majority of the water table at the proposed mine site was about 20 to 50 meters below the surface of the soil. This was important because the mine site is to drill 20 to 40 meters in. So the majority of the proposed site is likely to drill directly into the groundwater. By drilling into the groundwater, I was told by the local farmers that combined with the dispersive soils, this would likely contaminate the river, local dams, and anything dependent on that water. Because you see, the Mitchell River during the dry seasons when there's no rain keeps flowing. And it keeps flowing because it's able to draw from the groundwater reserves. And so are the farmers' dams. And it is here that the risk of contamination from the mine site of silica and radioactive materials and other waste products could leach through the dispersive soils into the groundwater and then further out and cause further environmental impacts and damage.
So just some of the complexities of it. This is a map taken from visualising Victoria's groundwater, which is the resource on groundwater.
Yep.
So the closer to red the colour is, the closer to the surface the groundwater is.
Okay, that's a lot of area I'm seeing on this map.
So the blue was the original project area. So you can see there's lots of shallow areas of groundwater within that system.
Yeah.
Now, they're talking about taking down, going down at least 20 metres.
So that's basically most of it. Most of it is that deep.
Overburden, and then another 10 or 20 metres of ore. So most of that area is within that groundwater system.
Yeah, okay. That's concerning.
So, and the groundwater has a really complex relationship with both the Mitchell River down to our left and the Perry River, which is off to our right.
Yeah.
And both of those rivers draw from the groundwater systems in dry seasons and then recharge them in wet seasons.
Yeah.
So any contamination within the ground and disturbance within the groundwater system disrupts that relationship.
And a very long time. So even after the mine is done and dusted, the effects will last through the groundwater for who knows how long.
you can't repair groundwater.
Yeah.
It, once you've buggered that system up, it's buggered for good.
Yeah.
You just cannot repair it. But as well as that major groundwater system, we're on a what they call a perched aquifer here.
Yeah.
So the dam that you can just see over the fence there, a dam just over the hill,
yeah.
And our dam off to the west a little bit.
Yeah.
These are dams that are tapping into a very, very shallow groundwater system, and they supply permanent water all year round, no matter how bad a drought is.
Yeah.
So there are, as I said, some of the records go back 170 years in this area, and those dams haven't dried up in that time.
Yeah.
My family's experienced, I think, the worst drought on record, and the only water we had on the farm was that dam being fed from the shallow aquifer system.
Yeah.
That's an aquifer that's only a couple of metres below the surface, so okay, yeah. Any mining is just going to permanently destroy that. If we look at the hydrography of the site,
yeah.
You can see on this, what we talked about on the tour, that there's actually two separate catchments.
Yeah.
On the eastern side, it drains all down into the Mitchell River,
yeah.
Which is a major feeder into the Gippsland Lakes and is a really significant fish hatchery for the Gippsland Lakes.
Yeah.
Lots of people go down to Painesville and Lakes Entrance for the surf and the fishing.
Yeah.
That's where most of the fish hatch.
Okay, yeah.
The other side drains down into the Perry River catchment, which is the chain of ponds, which mm-hmm. we were talking about before, which relies very heavily on the shallow groundwater systems.
Right.
But you can see how extensive those drainage networks are.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to control the flow off those areas.
So it's impacting life cycles of various species and ecosystems.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is out.
If you want to hear us slam the atomic industry, then tune into the Radioactive Show on 3CR, 10 a.m. Saturdays.
And welcome back. You are listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM on your dial, or streaming on the Community Radio Plus app, or on our website at 3cr.org.au/streaming. We are just in the middle of covering a mine proposed on the heritage listed river on Gunai Kurnai country in Gippsland that also feeds into the Gippsland Lakes. We now hear from Robin, one of the lead organisers in the crew.
So along here on the right is where they're going to put the processing plant.
Yeah.
So any contamination will actually go into the Perry River system.
Okay, yeah.
And that goes down to a very important vegetation or reserve area.
Yeah.
And that's called Providence Ponds, and then it goes onto the lakes.
Right.
So once again, you've got this problem of contamination of river systems, and with the stuff that they use in the processing, it's going to be an absolute disaster if anything happens.
And just to add insult to injury, they're planning on locating the processing plant and the permanent contamination from that on somebody else's land. They're not even going to put it on their own land. So some other poor bugger gets to live with the issue for the generations to come.
There's been a lot of work done by the catchment management authorities around here, replanting and fencing off and so forth, and also fish release into the rivers. And that'll all be wasted if this mine goes ahead.
Absolutely.
Talking about rainfall, we had 3 inches or 75 mil in 10 minutes one time. And there was no oxygen in the air. You couldn't see any grass. It was just water everywhere. And if that something like that strikes this mine site, it'll just be absolutely disastrous. It's very exciting. But there was one thing about it. There was no oxygen in the air. The rain was just so heavy.
Oh, wow.
You couldn't breathe.
That's insane. One time when we came down here on a tour, managed to see a azure kingfisher on the other bank.
Oh, amazing.
We've got platypus in the river.
Yep, well, that's another species that people are very worried about.
So the seam of gravel you can see there, that's where the groundwater systems interact.
Right,
so at the moment, the river level's right up, so it'll be feeding water back into the groundwater systems there in that gravel seam. When the river level drops, the water feeds back out and keeps the water supply flowing in the river.
Yeah.
John? What's the difference in water flow during a drought between here and wood and hillside?
So we're only using figures here, but say there's 20 megalitres passing by the Glen Allendale Bridge, 20 megs flow in the Mitchell here, and it can get up to 26, 28 megs at Kalulu, which the river gains water from Glen Allendale to hillside. So it gains that water through these gravel seams that's coming out of the hills where they plan to put the mine. And that worries us. Now, 8 megalitres or so in the summer is very important to the, whether it be the flow of the river or the horticulture industry. I'm very certain that it will contaminate the river, whether it be tailings or just simply rare earths entering the river. All that...
And potentially radiation.
Radioactive. It's in there. We know all the issues with the depth of that.
And project. So megalitre, how much is that again? There'll be a lot of people who aren't farmers here.
megalitre is 10,000 litres.
10,000 litres.
A megalitre is 1,000,000 litres.
Right.
So a milk tanker.
Yeah.
You're familiar with the nice big milk tankers?
Yeah.
They're 25,000 litres.
Right, yeah.
So we're talking 4,000 tankers.
Okay. That's a lot of Olympic-sized swimming pools, as they might say. So that is a huge amount of water coming through the river. That could get contaminated and move on to not only food production, but people's lives, ecosystems.
I mean, you've got multiple impacts. The obvious first one is the fact that they're going to draw 3,000 million litres out of the river. So that's a lot of, as you say, Olympic-sized swimming pools. And I can't even think in my head how many milk tankers that is. A thumping lot, as my dad would say. So just that sheer drawdown is huge. Then you've got the impact of them intersecting the groundwater system. So they'll cut off those flows that keep the river flowing during the dry seasons. And as John said, in the dry seasons, when nothing else is supplying the river, these groundwater systems are what keep it running. That's what keeps the fish breeding. That's what keeps the bird life and the wildlife alive. So if we cut off those groundwater systems, we're cutting off the dry season supply for the rivers. And then you've also got the contamination issue. There's yet another issue as well, which is how does the proponent stop dirty water from the mine running down into the river? Even if it's only dirty from topsoil, it's still sediment. It's still going to choke out the wildlife in the the river, the platypus, the fish, the microbiology. If you get too much turbidity, too much sediment in the water, all of that gets choked. You lose oxygen, you lose light, it chokes up gills, there's a whole raft of effects. So once you start scraping the dirt, you get one of these East Coast lows and 100 mil of rain, that dirty water has to go somewhere. How do you stop that dirty water getting into the river? So the only way to do that is to build dams. But we've got dispersive soils, and the Independent Assessment Committee said there is a high probability of catastrophic failure of dams. So you build a dam, fill it with dirty water, but it's got a high probability of catastrophic failure. If it's across that gully there, John might end up to his knees in his house with muddy, contaminated water. And once that contaminated water's on the flats, you can't clean it up.
We've asked the question, where is the water coming from? Whether it be 3, 4, 5 gigalitres of water to do this project, we've asked many times. The Mitchell River is at full tilt. It is fully allocated. There is no more water to be withdrawn from the Mitchell River. The underground system, we're looking at about the only one that's available would be the Latrobe Aquifer, which is it's fully allocated too. If anyone in this area wanted to get withdrawal water from the, there's no more licenses available. It has been shut off for around 15 years. So how the hell, where is the 4, 5, 6 gigs coming from? It's they can't answer. They're going to start drilling, research drilling as we speak. But there's nothing there. We can't have any more withdrawing.
Yet another complication is that locally we showed you that where the water storage is, which is just above, diagonally above John's place. One of the things that East Gippsland Water does to try and ensure water supply for the towns is it draws water from the river during winter fill, like now, and it pumps it down into the Latrobe Aquifer for storage. And pumping water down into an aquifer, it's not a bad way of storing water. You've already sort of got a mechanism there. And then in the dry seasons, they pump it back out. I'm not sure how they would feel about pumping water down into the Latrobe Aquifer to have their neighbours start sucking it out and using it for a mine that then contaminates their own water.
Yeah, absolutely.
One thing they wanted to do too was put in a big dam. We'll use one of the mining dams as a drought-proof mechanism for the vegetable farmers in the Lindenau Flats. And, you know, for 20,000 acres, you're going to need a very big dam, and also it could be contaminated water if it's coming off the mine site.
And dams are a bit controversial with in terms of protecting the environment as well, in terms of what impacts they potentially can have.
This was an issue that was explored with the first mine proposal, and it was absolutely knocked on the head by the water authority, Southern Rural Water, because the dam would be on private property, so any change of ownership, you have to renegotiate all your access rights. And then how do you get water from, say, that gully, 5 kilometres down the flats? Because the water coming out of the bottom of the dam is cold and doesn't have any oxygen in it, so you can't just release it into the river because you'll kill everything in the river. So you can't use the river as your conduit, so how are you going to then get the water down there? It's just a fantasy. It's there's no, it's all fluff. There's no no substance to it.
What about, you know, you look at the any contamination of these products into the river, whether it be flocculant, processing material, whatever. Like, we got the fish breeding ground down the mouth of the Mitchell here. Very important. All the platypuses, all the other things that live in the river, they're very sensitive. Frogs and that sensitive to any contamination. Or we all know those sort of animals, I suppose, are very sensitive. And they could be knocked down in a flash. We worry about the whole package of stuff. It's not just my farm here on the edge of the river. It's the the big picture. And the people, the residents that live near it. I fear for them.
And you've expressed to me so many times, all of you today, just how much you just love being here, how much you love the place.
Like dust coming off the hill. Like a few years back, the gum trees were flowering, and they do it every now and then. They flower every so many years. And the flowers from those gum trees off the plateau up here, the river was white with flower.
Yeah.
Even windy days,
yeah.
It all come and swirled down and landed on the river.
That would have been magical.
It was just, it was a sight I'd only seen about 3 years in 40 years.
Yeah.
And the river was white with this, the flowers of the gum trees. So you can imagine dust coming off that mine site.
Yeah.
Where's it going to end up? It's going to swirl down, drop in the river, and thanks very much.
Yeah.
And you've got to remember too that all this water goes out through the Gippsland Lakes.
Yeah.
So that is a huge tourist destination. Yeah. And if they start, they have in the past told people they can't swim, like at Meetung, that was from...
Oh, there were elders
there? Yeah.
Yeah, elder.
So, you know, tourists were coming and weren't allowed to put their foot in the water.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to happen if this mine goes ahead. The same problems are going to occur and they won't be able to be fixed.
Yeah. And that's all we have time for today. But don't worry, we'll be back next fortnight with more of the Mind Free Glen Allerdale crew talking about the various complexities and issues with this project. If you want to learn more in the meantime, you can head to www.mindfreeglenallerdale.org and you can also get in touch with them there too. If you want to catch up on today's show, head to www.org/killyourlawn to learn more. And until then, take care.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.